Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is John Campbell calling you now on Miracle Hour on bbsradio.com, welcoming all our listeners all over the world. And it's great to be with you. I always look forward to this time on a Tuesday lunchtime when I'm here in the wonderful North American continent, or 8 o'clock in the evening when I'm back in England. And this afternoon, I was due to have a guest on, an amazing woman called Angeline Toth, who runs a fabulous retreat center on beautiful Bowen Island, just off the coast of Vancouver, British Columbia. But Angeline, unfortunately, had some pressing thing that cropped up, but she is going to come on the show on the 18th, so those of you who'd like to make a note of that, it'll be on the website, obviously, but she's an amazing woman and an amazing journey, and she runs a fabulous, fabulous place with a great healing energy, which Mary and I had the pleasure of working at for some time, and it provided a sanctuary for us during a difficult time in our lives. So that'll be a great show. But consequently, it's left us, today I'm going to just talk to you all and kind of tune in with you and about whatever comes up. And, it's a chance for some of you who want to call in, because the lines will be free now, and I'll just give you those numbers for those of you that haven't got it. If you're calling from the USA, it's a toll-free number, 877-876-5227. And toll-free from Canada is 888-815-9756. And anywhere else in the world, you just dial 1 for North America and then 530-876-322. So it's an opportunity for you to call in, and although I haven't done this before, it's kind of nice, because a lot of people ask me a lot of questions as I go around, you know, the different parts of the world about the things that I'm passionate about, which is mainly kids, the new kids especially. When I say new kids, you know, the ones who seem to be about 1,000 years old when they arrive, and they have been kind of given a term, indigo children, and I'm sure that a lot of you listeners would have heard of that term. And although personally I'm not a great lover of labels, because it tends to put people into boxes or give people a preconception of what to see, so they miss the authentic experience in front of them, I do find that we are living in a world which uses labels, and unfortunately a lot of these children are being labeled things which are not quite so understanding and gentle, and, you know, they're being given labels of disruptive and ADHD and ADD and autistic and stuff like that. And although, you know, there are obviously cases where some of these children have some of these symptoms that are given those labels, I have my own philosophy and theory that I've drawn out of experience, really, of meeting these children, and is that these kids, they don't have disorders as such. I think they live in a disorderly world. And I think they are so sensitive, these new breed of children. They are so, so sensitive and operating at such high levels of consciousness and awareness that the education systems that they're subjected to, some of the parenting systems they're subjected to, and just the general what's going on in the world is so coarse for them that they develop anxiety conditions. Because I think underneath all these labels, underneath it all, is actually anxiety. And I don't know if I've discussed this, but my first interest in education, I guess as a kid myself, you know, kid born in the mid-40s, just after the Second World War, I was very fortunate, I believe, that my formative years from birth to 7 were not spent in the traditional Western world. I was born in India, in a little tiny hill station called Kodaikanal in the Tamil Nadu, what is now the state of Tamil Nadu. It's a not too far from Madurai in the state of Madras, I think it was then. And I grew up my first couple of years there, then went to live in Africa. And my what would be called KG years, kindergarten years, were spent, and early primary years were spent in Kenya, where I lived in a town called Limuru. And it was a time when the British was still had colonial rule there. But I think the thing that struck me was the freedom. You know, I went to a very laid-back kind of nursery-type school thing. But we used to, there was no real lessons as such. You know, we all played and we were subjected to nature. You know, we were out in the wilds with wild animals. And it was an amazing time. And we used to have rest. There was plenty of rest. Every afternoon we used to sleep. We all had our blankets and our pillows, and we used to have a sleep. So rest was honored, which is, I think, a big thing that we miss out on in modern day. And, there was absolutely zero pressure. You know, we learned at our pace, and we played. It was a lot of play. So it was a wonderful thing, and I loved it. That's what I remember. I used to love going there. I was living in a pretty dysfunctional home. You know, my mother was alcoholic, and it was pretty rough. But I don't tend to dwell on those things. I think that the school, in that respect, became my safe haven, and it was fun, and I had a great time, and enjoyed mixing with the locals, because the African people used to love children, still do, you know. And I can remember sitting outside the hotel that we stayed at while we were waiting for our house, and I'd spend all day just with the carvers, you know, the natives who were carving the wooden heads and the animals out of wood, and I'd go back at the end of the day laden down with all these gifts that I'd got from these carvers, and my parents wouldn't know how I'd come upon them, because I had no money with me. And it was a lot of fun. And then the Mau Mau, which was the local terrorist movement at that time, got pretty heavy. There was a lot of murders of children, you know, European children, and you know, they were fighting for independence and all that stuff. And it got pretty heavy, and my parents decided that it was time to come to England. And for me, the first time, I'd never been there, you know. So we packed our things in Limuru, and we jumped on a plane. And that was an experience in itself, you know, in those days. A little DC-3, I think it was, I don't know. And we came to England after we eventually landed in after a lot of scaring close shaves with the aircraft. We couldn't land at London, and we landed at Blackbush because they couldn't get the undercarriage of the plane down. So we had an eventful journey, and of course we settled in the south coast of England, and I went to my first ever school, British school, you know, and I was shocked, folks. I really was, you know. It was a shock to my system. I was a very sensitive young kid, you know, and I'd had this amazing first 7 years in this wonderfully free environment where we were listened to, and suddenly here I was thrown into this very typically British educational system where, you know, we're all called by our surnames, which I felt very, very harsh, you know. Even that felt very harsh to me. And I couldn't believe it. And I remember going home after the first day and saying, well, that was interesting, you know, what do we do now? What do we do tomorrow? And then, you know, my parents said, well, that's where you go every day. I was shocked. So, but the thing that stood out for me was I must have had a strong spirit of alive in me right then, because I remember thinking, I don't have to take any of this too seriously. And I certainly didn't. You know, so I managed to have fun, and again, because life was not exactly rosy at home, it became a safe haven for me. My school was something I looked forward to because it was an escape, definitely an escape for me, and I always made friends easily, and I had some good times. But also, you know, now I'm able to look back and think about some of the things that happened there, and that was not quite, you know, how I'd like to see it today. So I had a, how can I put this without sounding, I'm not a person that wants to blame. There's too much blame goes on in the world, and so whenever I'm making comments about these experiences, it's always my wish that the listeners hear the fact that I understand that really these behaviors and these conditions don't come out of, I just believe that everybody is trying to do the best they can with the tools they've got, and until they get to start to look at some of these tools with a fine microscope, you know, they're not going to be changed. So I really want that to be heard. But some of the stuff was pretty rough, especially as I got older. And but like anything, experience has shown me that in life, whatever difficult situations that any of us find ourselves in, there's always seems to be, we're given by spirit, I believe, we're given some safe adults. When we're children, we are given some safe adults who we can look upon as safe people. And, you know, and very often they won't be our parents, you know, if we come from, you know, real dysfunction. But it's like the great spirit, God, the infinite, whatever term feels comfortable with you, kind of knows that that's needed. And I really, really get that. And I think when everyone is, it gets one validating, you know, safe adult, that can be a tremendous anchor to their life experiences. And in my case, these were teachers at school. And, you know, I left school, not a great student. I failed all my academic examinations first time around because I was concentrating maybe too much on the fun. And my dad, who believed in strict education and all the rest of it. Mum was always very much coming from another viewpoint. You know, once she sobered up and got her life in order, she did some amazing things for the community and what have you. But she was never a great believer in the education system herself. And, you know, I can remember she was the one that used to say, don't worry too much, you know, don't worry too much about exams and that kind of stuff. So anyhow, when I failed all the exams the first time, Dad sat me down and had a strict talk to me and said, you've got to get yourself into gear. And I went back and, you know, I did just that. And in the year that I repeated, I passed the exams with, you know, pretty reasonable grades, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think this is one of the things which I find really sad about a lot of the children I speak to, and I speak to hundreds and hundreds of kids about what they feel about school. And the biggest concern that I have is that nearly every one of them that I speak to that come out of the traditional system, they all come out with the same thing. And I say to them, what's your passion? What makes your heart sing? What is it you want to do out there in the world? And nearly every one of them reply the same. They don't know. So after spending 14 years in an organization which is supposedly designed to prepare them for adulthood, to come out and not have a burning passion or not have a, you know, I think is sad. I really do. And I think that one fact there is something which ought to make our establishment, educational authorities, you know, and I think it's pretty standard all over the world. Have a little think about what's going on. So I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I knew absolutely that I had to get away from home. I knew intuitively, spiritually, something inside me told me this was the most important thing, was to get away from home and start, you know, being my own person and get away from the dysfunction that was there and the unhealthy patterning. So I, in fact, went off and joined the Merchant Navy as a trainee cadet, officer cadet, where I learnt my profession on the job, if you like. I didn't go to college. I didn't go to university to do it. I learned it actually on the job, so doing the work. And I found that was a great apprenticeship. It was fantastic. And eventually I went through the ranks, and I eventually became a captain when I was 26, and that was a very exciting time for me. And eventually went ashore and managed these ships. And I guess it was about 4 years, two or three years before I eventually had my own awakening. And a thought popped into my mind, and I had not put any energy into education, any interest, conscious interest anyway at that time. But suddenly I had a desire to connect with three of my old school teachers. I don't know what brought this about. I mean, I knew they'd be in their 80s, mid-80s at this time, but I just suddenly had this, I'd love to take these three guys out to lunch, you know, and to say thank you for what they gave me. I suppose I was in one of these reflective moments. But so I picked the phone up, and I called the Old Boys Association of the school that I used to attend, Brighton, Hove and Sussex Grammar School on the south coast of England. And I asked if these three guys were still alive, and they were. I was told they were, and I explained that I'd very much like to take them for lunch and have a lunch with them, and that's what was arranged. And I went out with these three guys in their 80s, and we had the most amazing lunch, lots of fun, talking about all the things that we used to get up to, and it was wonderful. It was really wonderful. And I came back home that evening, and again, you know, I was reflecting on the day, and I just asked myself, you know, put the question out there, you know, why did I choose, out of a staff of 42 teachers, why did I choose those three guys to invite to lunch? And, of course, it was obvious. The answer was clear. It was because with those three guys, I had fun. I really had fun. It was, you know, we would look forward to their lessons. They were fun times, you know. There was not any rigid control or anything like that. There was a constant, I mean, one of the guys was an English teacher by the name of Jack Smithies. Bless you, Jack. You've passed on now. You were just the greatest mentor to me and to lots of other people. And boy, did we have fun. You know, we were supposedly the C stream. We were in the C stream. They had an ABC streaming. You know, the A was for the brilliant guys, the B was for the average, and the C was for the also-rans, interestingly. And Jack would get us to write our own plays and produce them and act in them. And he always made a point, once we'd polished up a play, and they were totally our own creation, he would make a point of inviting the top stream, you know, the whiz kids, had to come and be the audience to our plays. And that was so clever, you know. I mean, I realize now what he was doing, because he just did not like that concept of, you know, better and less better and all that kind of stuff. He saw everyone as a genius, every kid as a genius, and he saw his job as just having to find out in which area that genius would flourish. He was a genius himself. And so he would do this, and we would perform the plays in front of the so-called whiz kids. And you know, you can imagine for 12, 13, 14-year-olds what that did for our self-esteem. So anyway, when I was reflecting on why I chose this, I found they were the guys I had fun with. And then, of course, I made the connection that they were my three subjects that I excelled in. And I started to think, this is so clear. It's so, so simple and obvious, you know. So the reason I'm giving a bit of background is because that must have started sowing a seed and just started to germinate. And it was another 2-3 years before my life had reached a rock bottom stage. I voluntarily entered a treatment facilitation for alcohol dependency. And during that time, I had this massive spiritual awakening. And came out and gave up my corporate stuff that I was doing and started to, study all these amazing subjects, which lit my fire. I mean, I hadn't even read a book apart from a few, you know, standard soccer books until I got into treatment and read the Big Book of AA. And when I came out and I was open to all these new ideas, my passion for reading, I just went into, I must have read about 100 books in 2.5 years, you know, just went into overload. Just couldn't get enough, you know, really nurturing my interest and my passion. And I read a book called Awareness by Anthony DeMello, which interestingly Mary's reading at the moment, and she's finding it an inspiration as I did. And in that book, Anthony DeMello talked about, you know, the shortfalls, the shortcomings of the traditional education system, just as I've been doing. And he talked about a school called Summerhill School on the east coast of England, which was a school where the children, the lessons were all laid out for the children, but there was no requirement for them to go there unless they wanted to. So they were literally left to their own devices with plenty of support, I should add. If they wanted to go into these lessons, they'd go, and if they did, they'd do other things. And this really lit my fire. When I read this, there was a surge of energy went right through my body. It was as though this was the highest knowing. You know, this was right. So I couldn't help myself. I just put the book down, and I picked up the phone, and I got directory inquiries, and I called the school. And it's about a 4 hour ride from where I lived, and I spoke to the woman, the principal there, who actually was the daughter of the founder. The founder was a guy called A.S. Neal, and this was his daughter, Zoe was her name, interestingly. And I called her, and she said, yeah, come on up, you know, and she explained that every Friday they had a thing called the meeting, where everyone in the school met, all the children and the teachers and the staff, and everyone had one vote, equal vote. Didn't matter whether you were a four-year-old kindergarten or you were the principal, you had one vote and it was equal. And they would discuss, you know, things that had happened in the school and the running of the school and any problems that had happened, and then they would vote on things. And obviously it goes without saying that the children had the numbers to outvote the teachers every single time. But interestingly, that's not what happened. And again, to me, this is not rocket science. You know, it's when people are given that level of freedom of responsibility, they tend to honor that. So I witnessed this weekend, and I had an amazing time there. And that really started my juices running about finding better ways to educate my own children, first of all, because I still had two children at school. And eventually then I was led to, I was doing a workshop, a rebirthing workshop with Binnie Dansby, and I met an American woman by the name of Mary Thomasian, and she told me about a school in India where she had never seen children like this in her life. You know, the children would be clambering to get into the school when term was ended. You know, they'd be at the gates trying to get in. So any school where that happened, that kind of lit my fire. So I expressed my interest to Mary, and then on a family holiday in the States, and she'd explained that she'd seen the school, and then she had come to America, and there was a prime movement of people that had wanted to replicate that approach in the States, and they did that in Austin, Texas, and they started a school using the same approach in Austin. So I flew down and spent a few days with Mary and went around the school in Austin, and then was so amazed at the level of self-esteem and confidence and gentleness of the children that I had to see the mother school. So I flew out to India, and I spent quite a bit of time out there, and I attended 2 graduation years, because the school in India has been going long enough. I think they've had probably 5 graduation years now. At that time, I think this was probably the 2nd or 3rd. And it was quite incredible seeing these kids with tremendous confidence, no fear of authority whatsoever, which is so good. But at the same time, very compassionate, gentle, considerate of each other and themselves, and just wonderful human beings. So that really started to it really burned in me to get something going, you know, in England and now in Canada, which could replicate that approach. Then I was led to the concept of Indigo Children, and that started to answer a lot of questions for me about my youngest children, because I had seen with both of them that there'd been a lot more wisdom seemed to be coming from their mouths, you know, that was normal for that age. And it's one of the things which I feel passionate about now, because unfortunately so many of the areas of society, A, the schooling system, B, the court system, the legal system, you know, where you've got cases of, custody cases, you know, they don't seem to want to listen to the children, because they don't believe a child of 13, 14 knows their own mind, which, of course, is absolutely ludicrous and is so unenlightened. And I don't know if any of you listeners have seen the little clip that's going around the internet at the moment, which is of David Suzuki's daughter addressing, I think it's the United Nations Assembly in Brazil, on a conference about global warming or the environment anyway. And this young lady is 13 years of age, and it is a phenomenal clip. And how she speaks, and the passion with which she speaks, and the honesty and the truth and the straight up, you know, it's well worth seeing. If you can get hold of that, it's well worth listening to. Because these new kids, you know who they are. These Indigo children, these wise, they know who they are. They know why they're here. The other thing about them, it's almost like they have an internal lie detector. So they know when they're being hogwashed by whoever, by parents, teachers, the government, you know. They're amazing beings, and they need somewhere where they can allow their skills to flourish and be honored, instead of having them dampened down and told that they're precocious or arrogant or, you know, too cocky and all that stuff. It is tragic what's happening. And in many cases, as I'm sure you know, they're also being drugged. You know, Ritalin, the use of Ritalin within our education system is reaching frightening proportions. And it's time that our people in authority start taking responsibility, because it is a scandal. And I don't apologize for the fact that it gets me mad. I think it's a tragedy. And underneath it is an arrogance that, you know, they won't look at new concepts or new ideas. You know, the court system has got to start realizing that when they have custody situations, they've got to start listening to the kids. Instead of, you know, it's the kids that matter. And they do know, and these Indigo children have got tremendous wisdom, and they've got this, the other facet of their character is they've got a warrior spirit, so they're not afraid to speak up. They're not going to start bowing and scraping just because the person is in some kind of position of authority, and I think that's a very healthy thing. It's not about, you know, I heard one judge recently saying something about, oh, that'll cause anarchy, you know. I mean, it was pitiful, absolutely pitiful. I've been shocked at the lack of enlightened knowledge in the legal system, both here and in UK. And, you know, judges especially and the legal profession have a responsibility to start opening their eyes, you know, and their first inclination is often to ridicule, you know. They'll ridicule. One lawyer was ridiculing the concept of Indigo Children and managed to convince the judge of that. And the thing is, it's all through ignorance. You know, it's like anything, any prejudice comes really from ignorance. And if they would just drop that that attitude of arrogance and just say, hey, maybe there's some information here that would help us. You know, this movement, this education movement, or this move for enlightenment and enlightened decisions by our leaders is not an attempt to condemn them or overthrow them, but it is just, you know, kind of encouraging them to say there must be a better way, because this way is not working. And this is especially true in education. I truly believe what the founder of the KPM approach to children said. He said, if we want to change the world, we have to start with education. And I believe that to be true. So here is a way, and there are a lot of different movements acknowledging this. And people ask me, well, what is this approach? What is it based on? And I think very simply it's based on the acknowledgement that every human being is born with an innate desire to learn. It's built into us. It's no different to our, you know, our nervous system or our, you know, respiratory system. It's a built-in, innate part of the human condition to want to self-actualize, to want to learn. So we're always seeking information, knowledge. So this approach honors that fact. So they're not coming from a consciousness. And I talk a lot about consciousness, you know, about where's your consciousness, where's your focus. It's so important because I think that our traditional systems are mainly based on a consciousness. We've got to teach these kids something. They've got to be taught. We've got to make them learn. And, of course, that's not true. They want to learn. So this approach honors that fact and is coming from a consciousness that the child wants to learn in the first place. So that immediately changes the energetic dynamic between the student and the teacher. The second thing that they accept, the people who are trained in this approach, is that also innate in that young person is a knowledge of what they want to learn. And this is where it starts to get a little bit problematic as far as discussions go with the traditional systems, because, you know, our traditional system is set up to say they will learn this, they will learn that, and by this age they have to attain this, you know. With these kids, they, and this approach, they accept and acknowledge the child knows what they want to learn. And again, you know, I don't think this is rocket science, you know. I mean, if any of us adults, I always do a little fun test with people when I do a workshop. I say, just think of something you hate doing, you absolutely detest, whatever it may be. Right, now just imagine somebody's now going to tell you, as an adult, you've got to go and do that. You have no choice. You've got to go and do that. How does it feel? What does it feel in your body? What's happening? And of course they get it. So why should the kids be any different? Why should the kids be any different? So this approach honors the fact that the kids know what they want to learn. So the way it operates is that the teachers are trained to follow the kids and let the kids guide them to what they want to learn about or what they want to do on any particular day or in any particular moment. So that's the second thing. And then the third and final thing, which is one of the biggest things, is that the children innately know when it's time to learn a particular thing, when it's time for them. Because, you see, we're all unique. We all have different interests. We all have different reasons for coming in here, you know, at a spiritual level, which, of course, that may not come in at a lot of education approaches, but we all know who people who are listening to this channel, BBC, radio, that we come in with a purpose, and that our job is to find out what that is, and these kids know when it's right to learn. And there's a very old saying, which I know many of you will have heard, that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And you know, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I had this concept really proved to me without doubt that if my psyche is not ready to learn something, it is going to let me know. It's going to reject. Because when I first started this journey of awakening, and I told you that I hadn't done any reading before this, and suddenly I became passionate, I was reading everything I could. So if somebody recommended a book to me, I'd just straight away go and get it and read it. And then somebody came to me one day and recommended The Celestine Prophecy by James Redfield. So I immediately went out, bought the book, and started to read the first two or three chapters, and I even bought the audio cassette and I listened to the first side, and I thought, what is this rubbish? What is this nonsense? And why did they recommend that? And I chucked the book in a cupboard. And then about 6 months later, I was looking for something one day and the book dropped out on the floor. And, of course, I realized that was my sign, so I picked the book up and I sat down on the sofa and I read the book from cover to cover. I could not put it down. It was so inspiring to me and it all made sense to me. And, of course, the reason that I'd had a completely opposite reaction 6 months previously was I wasn't ready. There had to be other building blocks in place on my journey before I could assimilate that information which the Celestine prophecy was giving out. So that was a great experiential lesson to me, how important it is to honor that fact that, you know, things will be received when they're ready. And this comes back to my theory about what's happening with these kids who are being diagnosed with disorders, is that they're being forced, information is being forced upon them, some of which they know is not correct information for them, but also that it's not the time for them. And then I think this causes an imbalance. And folks, I want to make it very clear, I have no medical training and I don't wish to put myself across as any medical expert. I am absolutely not. But so much of this is common sense to me anyway. And I think this kind of can mess up the brain circuits, you know, just as what happened to me, because I started to read so much, I got to a stage where I couldn't read a book. I mean, I literally, I would open any book and I couldn't even get past the first page. And I had a lot of great support around me, and people explained to me, look, you've gone into overload. You know, your electrical circuit, and you've just put too much information in there and you've blown a fuse. So, and that's what happened. And so for a period of about a year, 18 months, I guess, I just had to leave reading alone, and I had to give myself time for all this information that I put in to integrate. And I realize now how important that is. So that's the other thing, is that these kids, you know, they know when it's time to learn something. And it's been proven in the school in India, where there's absolutely no pressure, the same as the one in Austin as well, by the way, absolutely no pressure put on to learn to read and write, which seems to be the two things that terrify most parents and teachers, you know. Kids got to read and write, and I absolutely agree. That's an interesting concept. However, they had a couple of children there that had reached sort of 9 and 10 years of age and hadn't begun to read and write, but absolutely no pressure was put on them, none at all. And then within, you know, around that age, suddenly, spontaneously, they started to read and write. And within a few months, their standard of writing and reading had equaled their peers who'd been reading and writing from before. And it, purely and simply, it came so naturally and easily. But the problem, of course, is the fears of the adults around, family members, parents, uncles, aunts, neighbors even. This fear that they're going to be judged as something's going to be wrong with them, they're going to be looked down upon, and all that stuff, you know, which is nothing to do with those poor kids. That's the adult stuff. It's their fears. And these kids are suffering because of it, you know. So this is where we need people that really understand and handling these kids. And the other big thing I'm very keen on emphasizing is that whoever is working with kids in the role of teacher or parenting or whatever has got to be looking at their own childhood and healing their own experiences. Because, you know, folks, I've seen this time and time again. People cannot deny this now, is, you know, what we don't work out, we'll act out. And there's so much unconscious stuff being projected onto children from the adults' own experiences, which are just repeated unconsciously until they take a look at it. And, you know, Madame Montessori is a great educator who I have a lot of respect for her and the work she did with the Montessori schools. And she wasn't worried about political correctness. She just said it straight out. She said nobody should be working with children unless they're in some kind of therapy, healing, looking at what happened to them as kids, you know. Because it answers so many things about this phenomenon known as transference, you know, where we unconsciously will go through the same experiences we had as children. Even when we're in big adult old bodies, you know, it's quite incredible, quite frightening until you know what's happening. So these kids are protected from that, and they're honored. And a lot of the energy of the school goes into working with the parents, with the family members, kind of keeping them nice and calm and, you know, encouraging them not to worry, that everything will be okay. And because the important thing is, of course, that the child has a congruent attitude at home and at school. So with the homeschooling houses, which we are setting up, that's one of the things that will happen, is that there will be no exclusion of any child due to money or social standing or anything like that, but there will be a very strict boundary that only children will only be accepted where the parents are ready, open, and willing to learn about the approach, to do their own inner work, and to create a you know, a congruent environment at home, so that the kids don't go into confusion. You know, so in other words, they're getting the same kind of approach at home as they are at school. And it's a big project. I mean, it's a big order. It's a lot of people find it challenging, people from the existing system, and it all comes, I would suggest, from a fear that you can't let kids choose and you can't let them be free. And it actually, it's just the opposite. Because I truly believe that a lot of the problems we have with the adolescents and the youth in the world today comes from this massive, massive rage that they've suppressed when they were young, because they have not been heard, they haven't been listened to, they haven't been honored, and we've really got to do that. So it's an exciting, exciting project, and there's a great deal of learning that needs to happen within society, within the legal profession, the judiciary, the teaching profession, government, and the information's out there. There's so many websites now available. There's so many YouTube clips of these children where you can actually hear them talk about life and about what they're doing. And so there's no reason for these professionals not to open their minds. But it won't happen all the time. They're coming from a place of arrogance and ridicule. And that's what I really pray that will change, so that these kids have a chance. And it's a very exciting project. And what our vision is to open one of these schools, homeschools. They're all going to be homeschooling, so that the kids are actually learning in an environment which is the real world. And to have one in every area where the company who are going to be funding the project have operations all over the world. And there is a TV program being made, a documentary being made in England right now. We've been contacted, which is going to put out on mainstream TV a program about Indigo children, Crystal children, the new children in a nutshell. So it is getting into mainstream awareness. And it's really not before time. And there are some amazing, the great books about it. Any of you who are interested in the concept can always contact me at john@theangelproject.org. And there are books like The Indigo Children by Jan Tover and Lee Carroll. There's The Care and Feeding of Indigo Children by Doreen Virtue, who's a wonderful teacher and workshop leader and author, and talks a lot about these kids. And The Indigo Evolution is a fabulous DVD, which is a documentary where they actually interview these kids, they interview parents, they interview teachers, they interview health practitioners. Very responsibly made DVD by Jimmy Twyman's organization, and I recommend any of you who are interested to go to their website, emissaryoflight.com, I think it is. But if you Google it, you'll find it. It's a wonderful DVD, and will give you a great insight into your own children. If you've got children around this age, you know, and you're kind of thinking that they're a little bit different and they know more than you expect them to know, it will give you a lot of comfort, because that's what's needed. You know, people, I think, feel frightened when they feel they're isolated. And that's certainly what Mary and I are wanting to do, is to reach out to people and provide support, and give them resources, you know, because there's a lot available out there. So that's really the basis of the education approach, and it works. You know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and when you see the passion these kids have for life and the caring they have for each other, and, you know, the absence of drug and alcohol problems and absence of teenage pregnancies, and, you know, this is not rocket science. There has to be a connection between how they're being educated and what they end up doing with their lives. So it's a very exciting time, and if there's anybody that wants to call in, please do so, and go to our other website, which is miraculousrelationships.com, www.miraculousrelationships.com, and that's what we're also doing a lot of education around relationships, because that's another thing we're passionate about, is getting this information into teenagers, adolescents, before they start getting into serious relationships. And I don't think it's being done in traditional mainstream education. The strapline of our website is, the secret is in the selection. And of course that is the secret. You know, we were talking about this the other day, and how incredible it is that before we buy a house, we get surveys done, and soil surveys, and, you know, brick surveys and timber surveys and all sorts of stuff, and check out the title deeds and all this really thorough investigation. And the same thing if we're going to buy a car, we get the AAA in, or companies like that, to look over the car and look at the mechanical history. And then we just get into relationships totally unconsciously and wonder what happens. And there's a great deal of work that can be done there. In a very fun way. We do it in a very, you know, fun way, and people seem to enjoy it, and the lights seem to go on in their minds when they realize what they've been doing. And again, you know, it's not about blame. It's not about, you know, blaming or shaming anybody, but it is about consciousness and being aware. So education in all its forms is what we're passionate about. And we're very grateful for the avenue, the media of BBS Radio, to be able to have people on to talk, and we have some great guests, and I love the way this radio station is growing so fast, and all sorts of wonderful other ideas in the pipeline, and any of you people who care to look and see what they're doing, it's a great movement, and I really respect the people that run it. So that is basically what I've spoken about today is the education. I don't know if anybody is there on the line or wants to call in, but I'll be happy to answer any questions. And they can always call me offline as well if they want to. The contact details are on our website. And, I do encourage you to go on and Google for the young Suzuki girl to have a look at listen to her address to the United Nations, which was fantastic. She's a local girl here from Vancouver, and her father is an environmentalist. And I tell you, those UN delegates, they were blown away. They gave her a standing ovation when she finished her speech. And a plea to the legal profession, the judges, the lawyers, to start listening to these kids and hearing what they want to say. They do know their own mind. They've got an amazing sense of responsibility. But we need to hear them. There's a desperate need that these kids be heard. And together we can all work this place out and have a wonderful time, because that's what we're all to do. And also, I'm still having a great fun with the Course in Miracles, which is where my journey has led me, and I love it, and it's very challenging. And yesterday's lesson was incredibly significant, and it was something to the, I can't remember the exact words, or I'll have it here, but it was about, if I defend, I'm attacking. And it was an amazing piece of higher wisdom about the negative effect of defending even. I'm just trying to find, if I defend myself, I'm attacked. That's what it is. Great lesson, number 135 in the workbook for students. And it's a great course. I enjoy it, and it's very challenging. And I remember at the beginning of the course, it said that it will reverse the whole thinking of the world. So whatever I've been taught and believed up to now is like being turned on its head. And it's a wonderful, powerful self-study course. And I think it's really interesting that there's a lot of study groups all over the world have formed to support people who are students of the course. And I really enjoy, personally, I enjoy listening to workshops and tapes of people who were right there at the beginning. And the one that comes to mind is Kenneth and Gloria Wapnick, who were right there at the beginning when Helen Schuckman and Bill Thetford first disseminated the material. So, you know, they're very pure teachers of the course, and I'd love to get to one of those workshops that they run. And the other one, of course, is Gary Renard, who has dictated the Disappearance of the Universe, which is a great book that explains the course's principles in very ordinary, everyday, colloquial, fun type of language, because Gary's a fun guy. And I'm hoping to get him on the program if I can get him to track him down, because he's in much demand now. But he's a great teacher, in a lovely, easygoing manner, and a lot of humor. He believes in humor as I do. And it would be great to get him on the program sometime. And he's also had a second book come out called Your Immortal Reality, Ending the Cycle of Birth and Death, which is a phenomenal piece of information. And I think his third book is on the way out now. So any of you listeners who have been introduced to A Course in Miracles and who have found it as heavy and difficult to understand as I found it when it first came into my consciousness about 9 years ago, do get a copy of Gary's books, because they give a much easier record of what the course is about. And I know for a fact that so many people have been led to the course having never even heard of A Course in Miracles via reading Gary's books, and also people like myself who had actually heard of the course and maybe even had bought it, but it had sat on the bookshelf gaining dust, also have gone back and become dedicated students of the course as a result of Gary's books. So, you know, he's been in wonderful service, I think. That's the way I see it. He's been in wonderful service to the world. And there's some great DVDs about the course and how it came about and the number of people that it helped. You know, people who, you know, committed murder, been in prison and 15 years in prison and changed their whole lives about. It's an amazing piece of information. And I'm certainly glad to have it in my life today. So that's just about us coming to the end of today's program. I'm very grateful to all of you that have listened. I apologize that my guest, as advertised, was not available, but she will be available on the 18th, as I said, 18th of September. Angeline Toft will be on. And you're going to love listening to her story, because that is quite an amazing one. So thank you once again, everyone. It's always a pleasure to be in service, to share with you, and I look forward to hearing from some of you, and look forward to catching up with you on Miracle Hour next week. Thank you. God bless you all. Bye-bye.